Or is this a, whichever. Well, it looks like I'm doing cleanup here, folks.
Ladies and gentlemen, Seth Winter.
Very funny. Who said that? What? What? Thank you, George. Just give me a second here, folks. The joys of middle age. Yes, you too will get there eventually. Three pairs of glasses walking around. Yes, of course. Oh, wait, please. The subject that I'm going to talk about is a very, very important question after we've seen all of this, which just confirms a couple of things that I will bring out concerning the three previous presenters. If you have an audio archive at this stage of the game, in other words, you look and you see, besides having printed material, you have an enormous amount of non-commercial tapes and discs and even commercial recordings. At this stage, does it pay for you to build a preservation sound studio or even a remastering studio to play the material back? And is it feasible? Well, let me give you a couple examples of what has been going on in this business since the early 90s, when you could have called a number of different purveyors and gotten some very, very good, reliable, preservation equipment, as well as raw materials. Let's discuss reel-to-reel tape first. Reel-to-reel tape essentially has been around since 1948. It essentially died a few years ago. MTech, or whatever company has taken over MTech, has it available online. If you still want to do analog preservation, or it's recording to reel-to-reel tape, a 10.5-inch reel of MTech 911, which was the last standard considered standard preservation tape around, runs approximately $55 a reel now. I'm not kidding you, folks. You can look this up. I mean, when I first started over at Rodgers and Hammerstein 20 years ago, we were getting in, well, God help us, the Scotch 808, which went sticky shit. Right on. That was what was considered the standard preservation tape 20 years ago in order to do a project. Those are running, if I remember correctly, at the most, without the pancakes on them, the flanges and the hubs, we're running about between $10 and $12 a pancake. Then we went to Agfa 468. Thank you. That stuff still plays. But the price on that was going through the ceiling, and then, of course, what we're left with there. Now, when you are doing, as we have seen before, doing any sort of preservation or conservation to start with, of, let's say, analog tape, you're dealing with acetate-based tape, you're dealing with splices, there are a number of things you have to do. First thing is you need a quarter-inch splicing block, because you're going to be, many a times, repairing splices that have fallen apart, and many a times, my feeling is some places don't believe in it, I always attach, or I have to replace, leader tape, because if you're dealing with 50-year-old tape, it's high acid tape. That's part of the reason why the splice falls apart, because the acid has leached into the glue and caused it to fall apart. Back when I first started as an amateur 30 years ago, a reel of splicing tape, leader tape, which was paper, was $3, $4, $5 a reel, 1,000 feet on there. And we're not talking about, and I stress here, not buying what was used to be the plastic leader tape. You've seen those with the timings on them. For every second, it's something like 7.5 inches per second. It came in white and yellow. Those have a problem of developing a static charge in them, thereby, when you wrap it onto the tape, causing a static charge onto the tape and putting noises on it. We're talking just standard paper tape, which was called leader tape. Anyone want to venture what a reel of 1,000 feet of paper tape, quarter inch, goes for now? I said it was about $4 or $5 30 years ago. Anybody want to take a guess?
$20.
$24.95. If you buy 10 of them, they'll do you a bargain. They'll do it for $19.90. Now, the next part of it, the splicing blocks. Remember, you used to go into Radio Shack, bought them for $6-$7 a piece. If you bought the professional editals, those ran about $15 to $20 with the 45 degree angle and the 90 degree on it. Those are retailing now for $46 a piece. At one point, I had to get a cassette one about a year or two ago. The price was $120 because they're now being custom milled by Editor, one at a time. Getting an idea of what's going on here, folks? Analog has died. The ability to even find this material, let alone the prices, is going through the ceiling. And we're just dealing with the rudimentary part of just doing the basic conservation of the tape. We haven't even gotten to the point of talking about the machine to play it back on and then doing a preservation on it. I'll just give you another price. Wonderful. Quarter inch splicing tape. And this, the 620, which is the one that's recommended, that has been used for decades because it's not acetate based, it's mylar based. $7.25 a reel, 66 feet on it. Tactown tape, quarter inch tactown tape is $6 a reel now. Now here comes the real fun part. Remember what George Blood showed us concerning those flanges? In other words, when you have to, do conservation on acetate based tape and tight wind it onto a slotless hub and reel? The hubs are 90 cents a piece, but of course you have to buy them in bulk. A pair of flanges goes for $13.85. So start doing the math on how many 10.5-inch reels you have in your archive and multiply by that number. So essentially, a complete assembly is running you about $15. Then there are 7-inch slotless plastic reels, which I strongly suggest because of the fact that when you're dealing with smaller reels, that slot in the center will cause a deformation, and because the amount of pressure of it wrapped around will cause permanent deformation unless you get them onto some sort of slotless reels. There are a number of them out there. They range in the neighborhood of about $2 to $5 a piece. So I've just spoken about just raw materials that are available that are still left. Scotch also put out a terrific reel dispenser. It used to hold 2 7-inch reels, and those for the leader tape. You could put splicing tape on it, tack down tape, scotch tape, and all that. When that was still available, which was, I think, up until almost 15 years ago, that was retailing for over $120. Now, you call up a supplier, and they'll look at you and scratch your head, and they'll say, what the heck is that? You figure, why is that important? Because this puts all the tape, all the leader, in one unit, instead of standing with individual dispensers trying to pull the tape out, which is going to increase your efficiency in dealing with tapes and splicing and unsplicing reels. Now let's talk about the machines that are available. I called Atari. They still make the 5050 B3 tape recorder, which is the quarter inch wide machine. It will handle the playback of quarter track and half track tapes, running at a speed of 3 3/4, 7.5, and 15 inches per second. The suggested retail on that machine is $5,300 now. I also asked them, I said, you know, there were quite a number of quarter track 4-channel tapes made years ago. Rock musicians loved it. There was a TEAC machine. Steve, you've seen those machines, right? 3340s.
And 34B.
What was the number on that?
34B is the...
Right, 34B. And those had 4 discrete inputs, 4 discrete outputs, and they would send it to a mixing board and then make a 2-channel mix from that if they wanted to, or they would sometimes just combine the left channels and right channels separately and then shove it out to give you a 2-channel mix. Well, try playing one of those tapes back. I asked Atari, do you have anything like that? They said, yeah, we have what's called a Series 4-4 or -2. The -4 is a 4-channel machine quarter track, -2 is 4-channel machine half-inch tape. I said, what's the retail on that one? He said $10,000. Okay, so we are at a point now concerning just even getting the proper playback. And I haven't even discussed about what happens if you run into tapes that are running at 1 7/8 or 5/16. At one time, Atari did make a logging machine that went down that low. But he told me they had just discontinued it about 3 or 4 years ago. Those were the ones they used in radio stations for 24-hour tapes. But because now they're using servers, there's no point for these machines. And he told me the retail on that was somewhere around the same vicinity, if they were still making them. So we're dealing now with just the playback of tape, where we're running into this problem. Now let's talk about discs. You can get various turntable setups that are available. There's one on display here along with a phono preamp. You can go anywhere, minimum, from what I figured out, of setting up a proper turntable for playback. If you want to go searching around to do it, the minimum would run you somewhere around $4,000 to $5,000 to 11,000, up to the one that Dennis Rooney and I worked on 10 years ago at Sony Studios, the infamous Rockport turntable. And Dennis, what did that thing go for?
That was $45,000 10 years ago.
Yeah, $45,000. I don't know if you've ever seen a Rockport turntable. It sits on a marble top, linear tracking. It has two vacuums in it. One to that you turn on that causes the bass to float as the turntable's turning, and then another one that forces air pressure onto the arm so that it just glides up and down across a rod. The thing was the biggest pain in the neck to work with when you had a recenter disc because it also had a vacuum on it to lock the disc down. So it was ideally made to play LPs that were on center. It had a compressor in it that had to be run halfway across the building because when the thing kicked on, you couldn't be near it. It was so loud. It had to be completely, totally isolated. So we're dealing with the inability of even finding decent equipment. For example, I went and I called SME. I said, do you make the 3012R arm, which was and still is considered by many the standard archival 12-inch tone arm that will play discs up to 20 inches if the offset is set properly? And she told me over the phone, she said, no, we have something called the Series 2 and Series 3 now, which approximates it. It is not as high a mass arm as the old 3012R arm is. And Sumiko imports it from England. I said, so what's the retail on that? She said, that's about $2,500. Now, when the SME 3012 arm was in existence, we're talking 15 years ago, if Audio Archival 78s had it, I think it was running about $800 at the time. So we're dealing with the problem of two, even finding decent arms. Then finding a proper turntable if you want to do it in that respect, which was the classic, the SP-10 Mark III or SP-15 of Technics. You can find them used on the market. They do break down, but they've been very, very reliable turntables. There are a number of people sitting here, including myself, have used them for nearly 20 years. We use them at Rodgers and Hammerstein. Trying to find those are becoming near impossible because Technics hasn't issued that production, I think, since about 1990, if I'm correct. Then we run into another interesting problem, Stylite. I've seen a number of the different products out there with various size Stylite that were made to replace what Al Audio had put out years ago. And I hate to tell you, each one of those assemblies were not made properly. Tom Owen told me, because I had worked with him, he had a specially designed assembly made that was of low compliance that would take tracking weights up to 7 grams without the cantilever bending down. This is one of the important things that no one explained to you. You put too much weight on the cantilever that holds the stylus. If it's too thin, after a certain amount of pressure, it just bottoms out. And you've all experienced that when you put too much weight on a cartridge. All of a sudden you hear the scraping noise, and what's this? It's the bottom of the cartridge banging against the top of the record. Those assemblies haven't been available for over 10 years. And what has been out there, I've heard one collector, he said, oh, I bought these things, and yeah, I got the right size, but I put anything more than 2 grams, the thing bottoms out. There's another one available that Stanton put out that only goes up to 5 grams. You have a problem now, too, of also, sure, they don't want to deal with cartridges anymore. The classic V15 Type 5 is gone. The only thing, the highest end cartridge they make is the M97, which was okay, but not terrific. But that cartridge is not interchangeable with a number of the different assemblies that you could have bought of different compliance from Shure that would have fit the V15 Type 5. I had a number of those made. There was a series of Stylite assemblies they made called the N111, which had a very, very high compliance. Had them ground at Expert. They were terrific if I was dealing with slow speed cut lacquers. In other words, ones running a 33 and a third that had absolutely no warpage or deformation in them. I got some beautiful playbacks off of that. Try playing a 78 RPM that had a fast warp in it. Watch the tone arm fly off the record. What we are dealing with here is we're coming up to an impasse concerning trying to do this stuff on our own, when I say to an institution. We also run into a problem, too, of phono preamps. My biggest complaint, with the exception of the one I've seen outside, the Millennia, is that most of the phono preamps put out today are preset. In other words, What Gary was talking about before, and George, is that you need to do the ability to do variable roll-off and turnover choices when you are doing preservation work. You can't just plop in the NAB curve, the Columbia curve, RIAA, and expect that's going to work. You have to have the flexibility of a preamp that will give you a variable roll-off and turnover, because a lot of lacquers, instantaneous discs, are not cut with standard playback curves. And many times an NAB curve is not going to work, an AES curve is not going to work. It's the same thing even with the Columbia LP. Someone had asked that question. There are very early Columbia LPs that are not cut with the standard curve at minus 16 at the top. I found a number that were at minus 12. And what caused that in the days of pre-tape? The lacquers. That's right, Steve. I worked on some of those. I could pull up, I remember a Reiner session. The A lacquers were cut with a pre-emphasis of plus 12 at 10K. The B lacquers were cut with a pre-emphasis of plus 5. A completely different sound. And what makes it even more frustrating is that Columbia used to put on their, they tried to get three approved takes on a side, because it would hold that amount. You know, it's three takes of 4 minutes, 40 seconds if they could. Now, if they were lucky enough to get three sequential takes that they approved, one right after the other, it was great. They would dub each one individually for the 70 to RPM issue. In 1948, when they had to go and slip cue these things together to make the LP, remember this is not on tape, they'd have two machines set up and a third one that would be recording. The first one would start, and there would be a producer there, it was Howard Scott, he'd be sitting there with a score, and 20 seconds before he'd go like this, okay guys, I'm going to snap my fingers, shut that one off, and get the other one going. But what happens if you have the same take, the next take next to it? You have to use the other set of discs in order to slip cue them, which have a completely different sound. So that would cause sometimes a difference of what the proper playback curve was of a disc as opposed to what it was suggested to be played with. So we're really running into a major problem here of what to do. And mind you, we haven't even talked about the preservation system you want to use to record into. So we're talking an enormous amount of money that, from what I'm gathering, what I'm reading here, if you have different types of tapes and discs and everything else, we're talking a budget here of maybe $60,000, $70,000 before we even talk about dropping a needle on a disc or even putting a tape up to play it back to record it or preserve it. And my feeling on it is that if you are at the stage that you have a lot of non-commercial material in a sound archive, and you want to get it preserved, farm it out. There are plenty of known quantity studios and institutions that will do outside work. They're listed on the ARSC website concerning technical advice. Not only that, people are involved with other institutions, word of mouth. Call, you know, you can call somebody, say, how is this guy who did this work for you? Can he be, does he do work? Does he know what he's doing? I'd also suggest that if you go down and you want to do something, go visit the studio that the engineer or the institution is using. See what they have, what kind of storage conditions they have. Ask questions. And if you're not sure about it, bring someone along who does know to ask the right questions. And just remember something else. If you go to any place and they say, well, we can load in four tapes at the same time, you know, one big sound file and then separate it out, turn on your heels and get out the door right away. This is something that is time and labor intensive. Each item has to be treated individually. You cannot do a mass production of preservation on any of this. You have to be able to listen to one thing at a time. Now, another thing I should bring up about this. Let's say, all right, you decide, all right, I'm going to get the equipment by hook or by crook. I'm going to set this up, spend the money, have someone come in, build me a room with a proper isolation and set everything up. Who are you going to get to run the studio? That means you have to hire somebody. You then have to send them out to training to somebody who knows what he's doing concerning this material. And the person has to be able to also respect and know what equipment they are working with and the materials and be familiar with it. And that's another thing which I have found with institutions. They will hire somebody as a sound engineer, and unfortunately, at the salary rate that they hire them at, all right, they're trained. They may do a good job. They may not. They may be doing a bad job. We don't know until we finally listen to this stuff. 6 months to 8 months later, a year later, they leave. Now you're back at square one again. You've spent all this money in equipment, in R&D, and training, and now you're back at step one again, which means you have to find somebody else to train and do this. We are unfortunately in a period now where the manufacturers are more geared to digital than analog. The problem is we need those analog parts out there, equipment, and expertise that is shrinking. You want to get something done now? Farm it out. And I can tell you, most of the studios, if not all of them, that have done work for institutions, you can trust. Either if you have some legal, papers you want to send them, that the material is not to be copied or sent anywhere, that can be done. I have done that for a number of different institutions. In fact, most of it was never paper, it was a word of mouth handshake on it, and believe me, I'm sitting on material that I know a lot of people would love to get their hands on and they'll never see it. Because of the fact that I had intimate trust with the client that I was working with. So I hope this is a wake-up call, you know, in the sense of anybody who wants to try to do this kind of preservation. Because let's put it this way, it has become a specialist field. It's no longer the amateur sitting there, putting a record on, pushing a record button and say, oh look, I'm an engineer, I can record stuff, I've made a sound file. It isn't that. We're also running out of time on a lot of this material. We're dealing with lacquer-coated discs now that can be as old as over 70 years of age. We're dealing with reel-to-reel tape now that is approaching 60 years of age and badly stored. So that's my point on it.
Engineers who aren't getting any younger either.
That is true. Steve, let's face it. I want to commend you on something that you say. You're a man of 73, that is correct?
Yeah.
And that you go to your ear doctor to check your hearing at your age. Right. I'm going to be 50 in a month and a half. I've been in this business over 25 years. George, how old are you, George?
43.
Okay. Has anyone heard of any engineers of what we have done that are of a younger generation? I have not seen them. The problem is we are so separated from when the LP has disappeared back in 1980-82, that the kids growing up don't know what an LP is. We at least
they come out of the DJ community to replace us.
Oh yeah.
Don't give such a blanket note of discouragement to the people on the ground in the archives and in the libraries where this stuff lives, because that may be where your next generation going to come from.
But I haven't seen them coming asking questions about that. That how do you do this? What do you do? I remember when I first started at R&H, we had an assistant, and I was trying to show him how to recenter a disc, you know, a commercial 78, because 99 and 44 100% of the time they're punched off center. No, they never got the metal part into the press properly. And I'm showing this to him. I said, all right, let me know when you got it. About 5 minutes later, Seth, come in. I recentered it. He hits the start button and I'm watching the arm, and the arm swinging even further than if he hadn't recentered it. I stopped. I said, Ramon, here, look, let's take the pad off. Just put the record down. Just make a dub. Yeah, we got it. Okay. But like I said, this is something that you have to keep in mind. And the other thing is, too, if you have an engineer coming in to do work, are you a good enough judge to know if he's doing the proper job or not? No, it's when he plays you something back.
Probably not.
That's why I'm saying farm it out to a known quantity, to a known studio who has worked with this material. They're gonna do it because they know. If I don't do a good job, you're never gonna see me. And there's that old saying, if you do right by me, I'll tell 10 people. You do wrong by me, I'll tell 100. And there's a reason why these engineers, pardon me?
Be rant.
Excuse me?
Ranting.
I'm ranting. Okay. I'm just saying in the sense that there's a reason why there are certain studios and institutions that have been doing this for a long period of time and getting good results because of expertise. and also coming up with different ways of getting around problems. Yeah, yes, sir.
So when you say to farm out these jobs,
yeah.
Are the people that we're farming it out to, do they have a bandwidth for all these extra collections? Because the people with whom I have spoken at this conference that could have this work farmed out to them say, business is great, I'm very busy, I need more people. I've heard that from multiple people.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens when the people that you're trying to farm it out to and you can pay them money don't have the bandwidth or don't have the time to do all this extra work?
My suggestion is wait.
Okay.
If you want something done right and you have faith in the person, tell them, look, when can I send this to you? I've done it with clients. I said, look, I'm inundated right now. Call me in 6 months.
Okay.
Call me in 8 months and let's talk about it.
And my second question is how old were the people that shows the tinfoil photograph when the tinfoil photograph was in use?
They didn't know.
Of the gentleman that showed us the tinfoil
yeah.
photograph yesterday, did they grow up with the tinfoil photograph in order to be experts with it?
No.
Thank you.
That was an interest. But the point is that this generation coming up doesn't have that interest.
Huh?
Oh. In that respect. No, I'm talking about, when you're talking about tinfoil and reproducing and all that kind of stuff, I'm talking about the preservation end of it. Whoop. Any other questions? All right, one more, and then I'm going to get off here.
One, as far as tape machines are concerned,
what? Who's talking?
There's still a body of amphexes and shooters out there. They're not new.
Yeah.
There's still the knowledge to rebuild them such that you can get a machine a whole lot better than an Atari 5050 for substantially less than $5,500.
Mm-hmm.
So for the moment, the supply...
Yeah, but there's another problem, too, of getting things repaired properly.
Yeah, problem.
That's the major problem. I have one guy, and mind you, I'm in New York, so it's the center of a lot of things. There's one guy in Jersey that will do it. He just moved to smaller facilities because he said he couldn't afford the rent. He's not getting in these repairs. Knows to get someone like that to rebuild. That's also becoming a dying art.
Well, but for the moment, there is still the body of knowledge. You may have to ship it to somebody.
For the moment. But down the road, what do we do?
Yeah, no, it's not a permanent solution.
Sure.
I think you're overstating the problem as far as safety. At this point in time.
Well, like I said, I overstated the point about we're going to lose analog tape years ago. No one listened to me, and now we're all digital. You know, you'd be surprised how fast things will disappear.
Okay.
For the moment.
We got it right.
Okay.
Okay. On behalf of the title committee, thanks. And I was reminded to say that this meeting was sponsored by the Millennium Music and Media Systems.